will. And I'll introduce them later on. You should meet them afterwards. Now, really delighted that Professor Carter has agreed to do this first of what I hope will be a series of discussions. Now, I should say a little bit about the background to why we did this. There are two things. One is, one of the things the South Asia Center is aiming to do at LSE is that there are certain thematic conversations that I think a number of us from different social sciences and humanities are interested in at an issue level, which we talk usually only to our colleagues in our departments. The economists never talk to anybody but economists, except for people like the one sitting on my left, but anthropologists prefer not to talk to others and so on. But we do. We, of course, we all break boundaries. But most of the institutional conversations in a university are perforce defined by our disciplines and our departments. So we're really trying to create conversations on issues that a number of us studying the same thing from different disciplines are interested in, get to see whether how we can disagree, whether what complementarity is, what mutual learning there can be. Now, while this is part of the mandate of the South Asia Center, this year, as you all know now, with the new LSE director, Minu Shafiq, taking over, one of the first things she said, and she's giving her inaugural lecture on Wednesday next week on what she thinks is what she's calling Beveridge 2.0, to think about what the Beveridge report would look like now if it was designed for the 21st century in the Anthropocene. What would notional welfare, what do those five pillars look like for today? And no doubt she will spell this out in her lecture on Wednesday. Now, we had scheduled this before that, but we're very much, this is the first, in a sense, inaugural event of this year-long activity of Beveridge 2.0 at LSE. And we're really delighted that the South Asia Center is taking the lead and kicking discussions off. And there is a reason, and the reason why I'm standing up and talking is because I'm just going to show you some slides, which is to say that, you know, yes, the South Asia Center decided to, you know, we have a perfect speaker for it to look at one of the aspects of, under the broad remit of welfare of the universal basic income, which is a very hotly debated and a discussion with detractors and supporters in equal measure on both sides. But there are also historical reasons why the South Asia Center is the best or the entirely appropriate body to be initiating these discussions, because this is a visual, by the way, of the Beveridge reports. I don't know whether you've ever seen them. Nilanjan Sarkar, who's the deputy director and a historian, pulled them up as images, which I think are useful just to concretize this rather almost mathological document in our imagination. It was submitted in November 1942. So today is exactly the anniversary in November, at least this is the month in which it was submitted. Now, the links with South Asia, you need to, if you haven't, do go and see this wonderful little exhibition that the LSE Library has put on, which is, as you enter the Lionel Robbins building, it's immediately on the left. And they have this big poster here, which basically charts the long history between LSE and what was British India and then South Asia after 1947 and then 1971, you know, right from 1879. And the couple of key things to look at is that Beveridge himself, who of course was director of LSE from 1919 to 1937, was actually born in India. So he has a very strong link to India, and I'll tell you a little bit more about that in a minute. And Tony, an economist here will definitely know that name, was born in Calcutta, exactly where, were you born in Calcutta? Yeah, so Moitish is also a Calcutta man. There are lots of, there's an overwhelming number of Bengalis in this room, which is not a coincidence, I dare say. But we have LSE connections with Bengal that are particularly strong, but certainly with India. And then there are these, you know, Sydney and Beatrice Webb, who we all know, go out to India to raise funds and so on, and I'll come back to that story in a minute. And in this room, which is the Vera Ann Steele room, 1921, she's appointed as lecturer in economics at LSE. And if you go to the South Asia Center website, you will find a link to this marvelous conversation between Professor Mick Cox and Ramchandra Guha talking about this historical relationship between LSE and India. And Ram Guha has a wonderful little anecdote about Vera Anstey and how particularly concerned she was about Indian students at LSE studying and so on. So there's lots of reasons. And then Harold Laski, of course, it's famously said, influenced so many of the people in the first cabinet in India, in independent India. And it's an apocryphal story, but that there was always a chair at Nehru's cabinet, an empty chair for Harold Laski's presence. That was the influence that he had. And there's Krishna Menon and various people. It's a list of luminaries. But the substantive point to make today is that, you know, we talk about the Fabian Society, we talk about a certain kind of politics, and Sydney and Beatrice Webb talk about Fabian policy in India. And these are all photographs on my iPhone from the exhibition, so go and see the real thing. It's all attributed to that. These are all LSE documents, by the way, from the archives at LSE. Tim, come up to the table. You can't be the only one on the margins. There's space here. But this one, which I thought was particularly interesting, given we are sort of inaugurating our discussions on Beveridge 2.0, is this document written by William Beveridge himself about how his parents, who were in India, had a rather progressive take on issues of justice and fairness and thinking that always being in sympathy with the Indian desires to manage their own affairs. And so he was regarded as a dangerous person by the colonial authorities himself. And his mother opens the first college for women, which is multi-faith, and so on. So very progressive parents. And then, of course, Beveridge is sent to boarding school in England. And he and his sisters hate it so much that they petition the parents to take them back to India. So they go back to India, and he talks about his memory. And I think these ideas of justice and fairness and so on, as we all know, they have very deep roots in all our childhoods, but in Beveridge's case, there is this link with the Indian subcontinent that I thought was worth highlighting, just as a preface to what we're going to hear. And finally, I think this is key. It's a story that the South Asia Center has told many times to many people, including Ratan Tata and various members of Tata Sons now, which they're delighted to here, which is that, so the Tatas, when Sydney and Beatrice Webb go to India and they're trying to raise money for LSE, they meet Sir Ratan Tata and ask him to support LSE. And he says, yes, I will, as long as I will set up a post in social policy. So basically make academic knowledge useful to make the world a better place. So you can see the roots of you know, where this Beveridge report's coming out of. This letter, signed by Beveridge himself as director, is to Sir Ratan Tata, saying thank you very much for your grant. I'm sorry it's come to an end. Hope you'll support us in the future. But this commitment to thinking about the issues that you forced us to think about is something that LSE remains committed to. And that's what this letter is saying. Of course, the holder, the first person who gets this job is Clement Attlee. And then, 20 years later, becomes Deputy Prime Minister and then Prime Minister of Britain. So anyone who tells you we're in an ivory tower, give them counterfactuals, and they know that that's not true at all, because this link between creating academic knowledge that makes the world a better place is something that certainly is there in our historical record. And this one, this is also presented in that LSE Archives exhibition. This is fascinating. It is the welfare course that Tata money pays for. And if you look at what is being discussed, it's right from social history, industrial history, social economics, etc., through to, and finally, problems of welfare work and the factory and so on. So I just wanted to end with that, to say that We're looking forward to Moichish's talk very much. And while we do that, let's remember that these are stories with very long roots within LSE and also within India stroke South Asia.
Thank
over
you.
To you, Moichish.
Thank you, Mukhlika, for that introduction. Sort of saves me the bit I wanted to talk about the connection with the UBI debate that's going on in the world with the Beveridge Report and how we reform the welfare state. So, of course, you know, the substantive thing will come back, but clearly that's the big connection with the Beveridge Report. So this is a topic where, in a good way, academics are, in a way, catching up with real-world policy initiatives. But there are also, you know, these things go in cycles. There are earlier policy initiatives as well as academic discussions around them. So, in a way, my point of departure is what is going on right now in terms of this renewed interest, you know, in some ways trying to understand that. And in particular, we can go through, and I will have my take on it, the merits and demerits of UBI. But is there, in some ways, difference in the case to be made in the context of the developing countries as well as developed countries? So therefore, we can benefit from what is common, what problems are common, but also be careful about not to lump everything together, because then critiques of that would essentially, aim at the weakest point. Okay, so that's really the limited exercise that I want to sort of talk about today. But it's a huge topic. We do not have, as of now, many rigorous empirical studies available about the impacts of it, partly because truly universal basic income schemes that are genuinely universal, and I'll come back to, in a second as to what that means, they're relatively rare. There are schemes that are cash transfers, and there are schemes that are, do not have conditionality and so on. But universal schemes are relatively rare, and they're, as we speak, being experimented in certain country contexts. And I'm sure over the next couple of years, this will be an exciting research area where we'll have more and more evidence. So just to think about what, just to have convergence in our thoughts about what is a universal basic income. First of all, these are cash transfers. So that immediately is a major characterizing feature of it. And in particular, this is different from any kind of in-kind transfers that you can think about that people can receive, whether it's in terms of food coupons, whether it's in terms of actual delivery of certain, say, certain educational sort of textbooks, etc., whatever you can think of about transfers that are aimed at specific groups of the deserving population, these are really cash transfers. Secondly, and this is one of the really striking features, they're completely unconditional, and not just unconditional in terms of certain compliance behavior, like you need to have your kids in school in order to get certain transfers, as in the conditional cash transfer schemes in Mexico and Brazil. These are generally unconditional, you just get it. And not just that, what's interesting is it's also unrelated to demographic criteria. So, for example, to get pensions, you need to be of a certain age. To get child support, you need to have, children. Here, it is some kind of a per-person type transfer, which, of course, adjusts to family size and so on, but you don't really have to belong to any demographic or socioeconomic group to qualify for it. Okay? And that's really the interesting bit of the universality. And it turns out that's also the most controversial or problematic bit of these schemes. So most of the debates are where the third criteria involves the third criteria. So, and also as I go on, please stop me to ask clarifying questions, but I don't have that many slides, so I'm sure there'll be lots of room for general discussions and more sort of questions and thoughts that are not directly covered by my more narrow focus on it. So as I said, as we speak, you must have seen in the news, various policy discussions, that several countries in Europe and North America and the UK, whether it's locally or nationally, are trying out some of these, say the UBI, essentially as a replacement to some unemployment insurance type programs. In a randomized way, you're picking up specific groups of people, and instead of whatever they were receiving earlier, you're doing a budget balanced equivalent of a lump sum transfer to these individuals. This, the way I put it, is exactly the Finland case, which has already started. There are minor variations in some of the other cases, but this is what's really going on. Okay, so these are some of the pilot experiments, and once the evidence becomes available as to its effect on behavior of various kinds, labor supply, consumption, etc., then it'll be presumably scaled up. What got me really interested in it, because this is a broad topic and there are several people, including some very distinguished LSE social policy group. Certainly there are, there's a literature in the 80s and 90s, and Tony Atkinson. I'll talk a bit more about the history of the idea, but clearly there's a very distinguished sort of group of researchers and policymakers who have been interested in the idea. But those of us who are involved in development economics or development policy more generally, over the last couple of decades, I would say there's a lot of discussion about alternative forms of direct transfers to the poor. Okay, so in particular, compared to the earlier model of essentially what was in-kind provision, okay, now there's a genuine interest, you know, whether it's the Progresa in Mexico, which then morphed itself into, you know, Opportunidades and other cases in Latin America, like Brazil's Bolsa Familia. So whether it's the form of conditional transfers or unconditional transfers, in fact, in the last 5 to 7 years, there's been a number of studies that basically looked at unconditional transfers to certain groups of people. To be fair, this is not universal. So these are, of course, directed to a more sort of economically defined criteria. But there, what you're experimenting with is switching away from more standard in-kind methods of provision of various goods and services to these cash transfer programs, whether conditional or unconditional. And we, by now, from this big literature, we have actually a couple of reasonably good reviews. For example, Abhijit Banerjee et al., they have a very recent paper, and then there are papers by Bastagli, Evans, and Popova, who kind of look at various of these cash transfer programs in the developing country context, which give us a bit of a partial view about the evidence of it. These are not universal, so therefore they have to be taken with that caveat, and we have some of that. Now, if you think about in the developed world, what were the antecedents of the idea? So this is where some of the early utopians and you know, pagan socialists and others, and subsequently Bertrand Russell, they have been thinking about these kind of concept of demograms or something that is a fixed amount of transfer as a direct way of addressing the problem of poverty, or at least making sure that everybody has a certain minimum sort of level of consumption and minimum standard of living. What's interesting over the last, the second half of the last century, is one of the rare cases, as much as I began the sort of this talk by saying there's been an interesting confluence of interest in this issue in developing and developed countries, there's also an interesting agreement among some fairly libertarian-leaning economists who otherwise are believers in minimal state, okay, who have supported this idea, as much as more center-left, more traditional welfarist economists like Tobin and James Mead, who have expressed support for this idea. In fact, one of the major implementations in the earlier era, you know, as opposed to what we're witnessing right now, was led by Milton Friedman. Milton Friedman, who's normally associated with very free market, hands-off kind of policy ideas, his idea was a negative income tax proposal, which I'll come back to talk about in slightly greater detail later. But that, roughly speaking, has what we economists call a lump sum transfer element, and that is clearly related to this universal basic income idea. Okay. So in the developing country context, if you look at, so this was the antecedents in the developed world. In the developing country context, if you look at development policy, largely speaking, you know, like all classifications. There's some degree of arbitrariness in this. But roughly speaking, you can think of the broad types of development policies into three classes. One is essentially market-enabling interventions, where these are things where various activities or government policies and others are carried out to enable the poor to take better advantage of the market. Lots of, you know, microcredit would be a big example of, you know, this, right? The second is, of course, public services. A lot of things are not provided by the market and that are important in development, okay, health, education, other things. And you can think of a lot of other policies that can be lumped under this category of the broad provision of public services and infrastructure. The third is just pure transfer element, okay, where you're not necessarily intervening either in market access to the poor or providing public goods and services, but you're directly expanding their capabilities through monetary or in-kind transfers with or without conditions. Okay, so these are some of the antecedents. So the question that I'm coming back to, the limited self questions that I will focus on today, is essentially to what extent the cases for UBI in developing developed countries are similar, and, you know, but the complement of that, what, to what extent they're not the same. And in answering this, it's important to distinguish between what in the policy debates often gets mixed up are normative versus feasibility ideas. You know, UBI may be desirable, but it may not be feasible given the fiscal realities. That's a separate point, and one shouldn't mix the two up. You know, therefore, that would say that with greater resources, you should be able to do UBI, but until you can get there, maybe you cannot have it. Okay, so it's important to separate out these arguments. Okay, and also in some of these discussions, and I'll come back to these things, it's important to distinguish, to understand better the case for UBI in developing and developed country context, is what problem are you really primarily concerned with? Is it the displacement of workers due to mechanization, automation, as well as globalization? Is it the unemployment problem that you're largely worried about? Or is it really dealing with extreme poverty, and what is the best way to essentially transfer resources to the very poor? Now, they do not have to be mutually exclusive, but I'm going to make the case that the argument for and against UBI will partly turn on what you think is the problem that is to be solved. And this is a thing that I think, in my attempt to wrap my head around intriguing literature, the vast array of views on UBI and some case studies and so on, is, and people taking strong positions, a lot of the debates and the discussions turn out to be dependent on the idea of whether this essentially complements other policies, whether it's welfare in the context of developed countries or development policies in the context of low-income countries, or are they substitutes? A lot of the opposition you can see right away if you were to do some, you know, diagnostic check, that some of the opposition is clearly assuming that this is advocating getting rid of all public expenditure on, say, health and education. But of course, if you frame it that way, that's a trade-off that I'm sure I can't speak for extreme people with extreme views on this, but most people would not say that's a reasonable proposal to cut down or completely eliminate expenditure on those criteria. So now I come to the substance of this discussion over the next few slides as to what are the cases for and against UBI, and how do they differ by in terms of developing and developed country contexts. Now, there are two features, the first two features that I listed at the beginning, namely these are cash transfers, and they're unconditional, that you don't have to really satisfy compliance criteria in terms of behavior or certain features of your socioeconomic condition. These turn out to be very similar if you read through a lot of the policy writing on this issue. Okay? In particular, the main case that people make for UBI, okay, is that it cuts a lot of administrative costs in carrying out. So it's a supply side argument that you can cut the costs of direct provision of certain types of, you know, private goods, rather giving people a cash transfer so that they can choose for themselves. And indeed, therefore, The flip side of cutting this administrative cost is also empowering citizens and individuals to choose what they think is the most appropriate for them. Okay, so that argument seems to be commonly applied both in the developing and developed country context. So this is where there is a commonality. And a related argument, which as economists perhaps we are very, very quick to focus on it, most of the other forms of transfer that we can think of is intended, in-kind transfers or conditional transfers, they would lead to various types of distortions in the resource allocation, and therefore a strong argument for UBI or unconditional cash transfers more broadly is that it's going to avoid subsidies. For example, if you want to, you know, give people subsidies for food, subsidies for fuel, etc., there are standard inefficiencies that you're distorting prices and therefore leading to overuse of certain things and inefficient outcomes as a result of that. Okay? So these arguments are kind of common. Now, having said that, as some of the critiques of UBI, for example, John Dress in the Indian context, a friend of mine and many others in the room know him or his work well. The argument is that, look, this administrative cost argument has to be taken carefully, because in the developing country context, it's not the case that you don't have any administrative costs associated with cash transfers too. So in other words, given the insufficient development of the financial infrastructure and general problems of corruption and bureaucracy, it's not the case that the moment you switch to cash, it's going to be costlessly implemented, whereas all the other types of transfer programs will have these problems with them. So another concern, so that is a critique that is raised in the context of UBI, that's common to both developed and developed countries, is the fact that essentially it boils down to a paternalistic concern. Our people just take this money and then use it in a way that somehow society doesn't deem to be the right way to do it. Okay, so this is classic paternalism argument, namely people can just sit at home and not do much, or they might spend the money on undesirable types of activities like, you know, drinking, gambling, etc., whatever is the case, as opposed to more meritorious consumption where society can, is the classic deserving versus undeserving poor idea that goes back to a lot of policy debates in the UK in the 19th century and so on, right? So these arguments are somehow interestingly common in both the country contexts. But as far as the paternalistic argument is concerned, here my knowledge is largely restricted, and I would not like to stick my neck out and say that this is it's because of my insufficient knowledge of the developed country empirical literature on it. But most of the work that I could lay my hands on have to do with evidence in the developing country context as to how valid is this argument of essentially wasteful or inessential form of consumption or use of this cash transfers. So, which is to say that I would be very happy to hear about developed country studies which do similar things, in particular with reference to labor supply, how you spend your money in terms of various consumption goods. So there are a number of recent papers. So Banerjee et al. Have a nice paper where they have essentially reanalyzed the results of certain randomized controlled trials, and which basically look at government-run cash transfer programs from six countries worldwide, and essentially find no systematic evidence of impact either on the propensity to work or the overall number of hours worked for either men or women. So this is one of the studies based on these number of experimental design, which basically find that the worry that these transfers is going to essentially lead people to supply less labor, that doesn't seem to be founded. But this is not in the developed country context, so therefore that has to be kept in mind. And as far as consumption is concerned, Evans and Popova have a paper which review evidence from various studies, 19 actually, on essentially the impact of cash transfers on what economists now have started calling temptation goods, which are largely defined to be alcohol, tobacco, these kind of things. And essentially they find that there is very little impact of these transfers on expenditures on alcohol and tobacco. Okay, so therefore, going back to this idea that one concern about this cash transfers and conditional transfers is that it might lead to reduction in labor supply or in terms of inessential or non-meritorious consumption that doesn't seem to be valid, at least in the developing country context, okay, based on these studies. Now, it's the third feature of the UBI, which I think truly makes it an interesting and distinctive policy proposal compared to cash transfers that sort of have been around for some time. That is the one that is the most debated, and this is also where some of the arguments for and against diverge when you look at developing country contexts and developed country contexts. Okay, as I said, the earlier ones are largely similar, and that's where it's interesting that doing welfare and doing development policy and having UBI as a proposed policy, the first two arguments are very similar across very different country settings. So what's the third feature? That's its universal. Now this really, it's seemingly a nice sounding term. You know, we are all universalists, at least I am. That sounds a nice sounding term, but it is very, where there's a lot of, it is a very strong element of the policy package, and it is strong because of the following reason. That under this policy, the richest person and the poorest person will all get the same money. Okay? Now, of course, if you frame it this way, this sounds completely insane on fairness and other grounds. But the reality is, of course, nobody actually proposes it, because through the tax system, it is understood that you can claw back some of the benefits that people above a certain income level will do. So, for example, you can just say, look, I'm going to give, say, X pounds per month or per year to everybody. But then you raise taxes exactly to be earmarked to fund for this, so that whether it's on income, whether it's on wealth or other things, and then you can basically de facto, it's going to wash out, because it'll de facto be a transfer from the richer sections to the poorer sections. Okay? But still, this is the bit that is debated a lot. Now, what is the argument? So, but still, there's a sense in which it's a little bit of a, what can you say, tortuous process, where you first give out this money, and then you say, hey, I'm going to use another instrument to claw it back. And that's something that people have sort of, there's a lot of discussion around whether this is a good policy or bad. But before I get into that, I should also point out that this is also what makes the feasibility arithmetic the most difficult. Because anything you want to give out to a population, the full population, if you calculate the budgetary bill, that usually turns out to be a fairly big number. And therefore, a lot of the kind of critique or negative discussion around UBI has to do with this idea that how are you going to come up with the fiscal resources, what kind of cuts in other expenditure, what kinds of offsetting tax increases will fund for this. Okay, so universalness or universality of the proposal has these problems. Okay, now of course, why do people do it then? If it's sort of seemingly a little bit of a strong feature that obviously has some negatives associated with it. It is doing it because in one stroke, it gets rid of the means testing issue completely. Any other policy that has any degree of sort of conditionality or means testing, you have to have somebody checking whether you're qualified or not, you're eligible or not, okay? And that is where you can have, for reasons of bureaucratic inefficiency, reasons of fraud, reasons of corruption, the standard inclusion and exclusion errors. Namely, people who shouldn't be qualified to get this, get it. That's the inclusion error. And the exclusion error is people who are deserving and are outside the net. And these are clearly the problems of a lot of targeted policies. And that's what UBI tries to circumvent.
Sorry,
can I just
ask?
Yeah, please.
Let's ask a question about the National Rural Employment Guarantee Scheme in India.
Yeah.
Which the means testing is through self-selection.
Right, right.
So how would that fit in this point?
I'm coming to that in just a few slides, because that's a very good comparison in terms of exactly that policy I'll be discussing. So as I already said, that on the negative side, while it avoids the inclusion and exclusion errors, it is basically the direct cost is high, but as I already said, that it does come with complementary proposals for either tax increases or offsetting other forms of direct transfer programs, etc. And therefore, that critique that it's really kind of something that's unfair, that is less of an issue. But this is where I'm going to make the first, to me, conceptually important point. Because if you want to think about universality and the fact that you can claw back the benefits through the tax system, it assumes a certain degree of state capacity. Okay? And that is where the developing and developed country contexts are extremely different. Okay? So we have Tim Leslie here, who has worked on state capacity and so on. But here what I have in mind is a very simple fiscal capacity idea. Just to give an example, in India, where 2.3% of the population file tax returns, and 1% actually pay taxes, with the remaining 1.3% filing, but their incomes falling below the threshold to be actually having to make a transfer. Okay? So that's kind of insane, right, in terms of having a tax net. And part of the reason, there are lots of reasons for it, and I'm happy to come back to it if there are discussions, but let me not get too sidetracked. The main reason is, of course, the vast presence of the informal sector, which is outside the net of taxes and regulations. That's one big argument why this is the case. And the second is a legal reason, where essentially agricultural income by policy is tax-free. Okay? And as a result, these are the reasons why these numbers kind of stand out. Indeed, if you look at the state capacity or fiscal capacity argument, the Indian government's economic survey essentially shows that there are 7 taxpayers out of every 100 voters in the country, which is an interesting way of looking at it. In contrast, the figure for Scandinavian countries is, as seems to be the case with many other statistics, that's nearly perfect. It's 100, okay? And even if you take in the other developed countries, these numbers range in the 60 to 80 range. So these are the number of taxpayers out of every 100 voters, and that clearly has a very different fiscal reality. So basically this means, I'll come back to the MG-Narega comparison just in a slide or two. This basically means the scope for a UBI is much more limited than a developing country setting. So just by the state capacity argument, okay, because you want to claw back, you just don't want to drop or give away lots of money. To the extent this clawback instruments are more limited in the developing country context, this immediately restricts how far you can go push with a purely UBI argument. Okay? Now, it does seem that the developed countries, I've seen this argument made, but I don't think that's a very strong argument. The developed countries can afford any form of extra expenditure better, but that's clearly not a very tenable argument, because there's a sense in which poverty is always, to some degree, relative. The money you need to help somebody who's below the poverty line in the UK is not comparable to the money you need in the Indian context. So only if you confuse the context that for the Indian budget needed for this, if Germany would have to pay for it, then that seems easy, but that's not the right thought experiment to do. Okay? So therefore, even in the US context, therefore, there is, of course, once you decide what's the poverty line and what percentage of average income that is, that will give you some tough arithmetic in terms of the taxes that would be needed. So therefore, in that sense, it's not an easier problem for developed countries too. What is easier, though, is that in principle you have the fiscal or state capacity to implement it better, much better, if you look at these numbers. So if you, just to give an, I did some simple back of the envelope calculations. In India, giving everyone a sum that equals yearly income corresponding to the poverty line would be about 10% of the GDP, where in the US case, if you again take the poverty lines exactly as they're officially given and compare that as a fraction of GDP, that's 20%. So therefore, without thinking very hard, this would be the equivalent taxes that would be needed out of average income to pay for these, right? So therefore, one reality that is true of both developing and developed countries is that they have to be scaled down to the sums that are adapted to the particular country context. But this is where, ironically, I'm going to make a case that once we accept the scaling down point, then the case for having this in developing countries become pretty strong, because essentially you can, especially given the cost of some of the other transfers and the wastefulness involved in some of them, you can do, so long as you don't call it a basic income that will essentially solve the problem of poverty, if it's a matter of some income supplement or cash income supplement that can be given out universally, I think the case becomes sort of stronger in the developing country context. Okay? So if you think about, really, then if I compare developing and developed countries, so far I kind of made the state capacity argument and the fact that in the developing countries, the state capacity is more limited, and therefore in general, for both set of countries, you have to scale down your ambitions in terms of how much you can do it. But given this, it will have more of a marginal impact once you scale things down in a developing country context than in the developed country context, given the abject level of poverty and so on. Now, if you then turn to more the non-state capacity type arguments, more economic fundamental arguments, you know, how are markets fundamentally different between developing and developed countries? How are the economic structures different? Now, as I mentioned, that in the developed country context, most of the discussions have been in the context of globalization and automation and so on, so that essentially there is a worry that we are moving to a new gig economy where essentially the standard forms of employment are kind of vanishing, okay? Given this, the need for a social safety net, given the need for kind of social insurance, that's stronger. And also, I think, interestingly, some of the argument in the developed country context is driven by the inequality, focus on inequality that we have been seeing for the last 10 years or so. And that too has essentially renewed the interest in having these kind of universal basic income. Now, it's in the developing country context, though, it's largely the problem of extreme poverty and the consensus around the fact that poverty alleviation should be one of the central policy objectives. That's where most of the debates about UBIs around. So this is to give you a sense as to when you figure out the pros and cons and the terms of the debate. In the developed country context, it's very much a labor market centered argument, okay? And therefore, some of the pros, cons, whether this is gonna be good or bad, is labor market surrounded. But in the case of, not exclusively though, there is a certain element that is pure welfare, that you're really providing a safety net for people falling below a certain level. But in the developing country context, it's really the extreme poverty and whatever is the best instrument to alleviate that, even if you need a bunch of instruments to do that, that's where the UBI kind of discussion has to be located. Now, I think the labor market argument in the developed country is quite strong, but I don't think for inequality, that's not the animal that this instrument is best aimed or best suited to kill, because in the end you need progressive taxation, and you can easily show that standard basic income packages with proportional income is an only very imperfect way of getting the progressivity, and therefore if inequality is the main problem you're thinking about, then UBI is not the best solution. It can be part of the mix, but that should not be your main instrument. Whereas if you think about more the labor market, unemployment insurance, then it's more of an issue. Okay, so I've already mentioned the context of state capacity, etc., and therefore, I think coming back to our broad discussion as to what is the case to be made for a UBI, the main argument, if you look at the public debate context, is it will deplete funds for other welfare policies or other anti-poverty policies. And that is exactly what I think, going back to what I said, that developing countries, should be able to afford something at a much smaller scale, and so long as it's not completely displaced other policies, for example, public investment in education, health, etc., then I think, you know, a lot of the, for example, Jean Drez's worry, if you look at a number of his pieces, is really that he thinks this is a way of the state washing its hands off of any form of responsibility for providing a public goods and services. Now I come to the Noriega point. So it took a few more slides than I had thought. So I now want to wrap up. I just want to make a couple of general points about how do we think about, because in the end it's a policy choice problem that, at least as an economist, that I'm looking at it. So therefore part of this discussion, or at least in this somewhat simple exercise, was to understand what is the instrument and what are the objectives it's trying to achieve, and to the extent this instrument to objective connection, how does it differ between developing and developed country context? So that was the kind of scope of the very simple and limited exercise I was doing. But in this case, maybe it is superfluous. Most of the points I'll say here are completely well understood, and you can all nod politely and think, well, we knew all of this. But in the policy debates, it's sort of very interesting that people think that finding out one fault of a policy is kind of fatally damaging to that policy proposal. And I find, as an economist who's trained to think about costs and benefits, every policy is imperfect. So therefore, there's no perfect policy, right? And therefore, we shouldn't even think about perfect policies. Whatever policy you propose, if you think UBI is bad, you tell me your policy. I'll easily find the weakest point I can shoot at that policy. Right? And therefore, that should not be the exercise. The point is to not have perfect policies, but the point is to have the understanding of alternative imperfect policies. And this is exactly where the employment guarantee scheme in India, okay, offers a very good concrete example of this choice. If you look at the employment guarantee scheme, which is called National Rural Employment Guarantee Scheme, which is named after Mahatma Gandhi, so that's, it's called MG Narega, is the acronym, or at least the Indian way of pronouncing that acronym. It's sort of, what it is it gives every able-bodied adult 100 days of guaranteed employment at the minimum wage, if they were to seek it. Of course, if you have a job, it doesn't matter, but suppose I lose my job, in the current environment in the UK post Brexit and all of that, then I go back to my ancestral village. Essentially, what I can do is I can have 100 days of guaranteed employment at this thing, and usually, just one second, let me finish this, I'll take it. It will be to perform some public service or public project, well, I'll have to work, and then I'll be paid. Yeah.
So, what happens after those 100 days?
You're on your own. So it only guarantees a limited amount of number of days that you qualify for.
And it's one person per household, not per
exactly person. One person per household.
And it's at the minimum wage.
It's at the minimum wage, exactly. And it is demand driven. That was the big innovation under the previous United Progressive Alliance government. It basically means you can knock on the door and say, I need the job. And that's why, you know, then the village authorities are supposed to then fit you into some public works program and so on. And one of the, just a side remark, one of the key interesting features after the, what in my opinion and many others, hugely misguided demonetization exercise in India, was this was a big uptake in Narega usage, because essentially a lot of informal sector workers lost their jobs, they went back to the villages, and they were asking for this, these funds. Okay? So essentially, if I now compare with Narega, what's the cost and benefit? Now clearly, the cost of Narega, as some of the critics have pointed out, there is an element here distorting the labor market. Okay, clearly these people would have some job options. Now, how good a job option, how tight the labor markets are, these are of course variable. But clearly, you're offering this subsidized at the cost to the taxpayer, something that is a labor market intervention. Whereas if you could just give a cash transfer, that would not be there. But what's the advantage of NREGA? It's self-targeting. It's exactly going back to some of the literature on welfare versus workfare that, for example, Tim worked on. It's essentially, rather than trying to think about all the inclusion and exclusion error, here the understanding is that people will sign up for NREGA only who need it, okay? Others are not demanding it, and therefore you get rid of the problem of universal schemes, which are quite expensive because of their scope. But the disadvantage is, of course, in an ideal world, if you could give people the money that they need and then keep them free to seek employment in whichever way they want or not do anything, that would be a better policy than essentially giving them the money and saying, you work in my backyard. So that's a kind of labor market distortion, as opposed to, look, you have this money, you can work in my backyard if that's the best option you have right now, but you're also free to go to the city and work and so on, you'll still get the money. So that way, clearly, the universal basic income would be better. Two more points, and I'll wrap up my discussion and open the floor to your thoughts and comments. The second is, and I think this is very important broadly in the context of not just this policy, but many other policy debates, we should not think of a single policy that will be a magic bullet for everything. Okay, so we should therefore universal basic income, even if whether we have adopted in the developing country context or a developed country context, should be part of a broad range of policies. Okay, so of course there are trade-offs. So if you do universal basic income, some of the funds will have to be cut somewhere else and or taxes raised. But nobody responsible should be advocating that we should basically have a very little activity on all the other regards. Okay. And basically, because of this, there's also, I'm sorry, I think I made I framed the points, I see, mixed up the sequence. So this was really the third one, that there's no magic pill, right? So therefore, you should not think that this policy will open. But also, this is the point, there should also be a treatment fitting the illness issue. So in other words, universal basic income may be very good at solving certain problems of abject poverty. Or think about what, for example, Pranab Barthan has made forcefully this argument, that in the developing country context, gender discrimination, which exists everywhere else, in the developing country context, given the position of women, this might be a tool that could essentially empower them, and therefore that's a strong argument to be made for that, okay? And similarly, there are certain activities that are considered socially degrading. For example, scavenging, manual scavenging, and so on. Again, it's Pranab has made this argument, and others have made it too, that essentially this would be a way of inducing society to shift the labor force away from some of those activities and maybe have more mechanized solutions and so on. Anyway, leaving that point aside, the point I'm trying to make here is that clearly this would not be of help to a small entrepreneur whose entire thing is, how do I have access to market? How do I have transportation? Therefore, I can take my goods to the town and so on. You cannot essentially, therefore, you should not have one policy that will be, you know, the best fit for everybody. And therefore, we should not only think of the perfect policy that solves everybody's problem, we should also think about what treatment fits what disease. Okay? And therefore, I'll just stop here. I have, you know, some more thoughts and ideas on it, but I would much rather open the floor and have your thoughts and views on it.
Thank you, Maitreya. Okay, this, while it may feel like a seminar and questions, I particularly wanted to invite, I know we have a wide range of disciplines around the table, so of course we want questions addressed to Maitreya, but if you want to give a couple of sentences of background of how you come to this topic through your research, please do, and do say what kind of discipline you're coming from, because we don't really know each other. So why don't you go first?
Hi, everybody. My name is Julio Linares. I'm from Guatemala, and I lived in Taiwan for 6 years. And during my time there, I started working on basic income as a research, specifically ways of financing basic income. And eventually, I got here, and I'm doing now a master's in anthropology and development. And my research is on basic income. And my question or topic of discussion that I want to bring out is this idea of state capacity. You know, the point was raised around the idea of taxation. But there are different ways in which you can fund basic income. For example, the Alaskan example of the oil fund that they have is a way in which they have a collective ownership of resources, and then the money goes back to people as a dividend. There's also the idea of sovereign wealth funds. So you could create in every country that has enough foreign exchange reserves. You use that money as a way of creating a fund that invests money so as to create a sustainable way of living, basically. And so you can have mixed systems, right? So that is an idea that I think is good to have as a way of not just focusing on taxation, because it limits the possibilities and for the imagination.
Okay, thank you. Let me collect, or let's have a more free-flowing thing,
yeah.
But I'll come back to it. I've noted it down, and I'll come back to it, and maybe others can comment on it too.
Adnan and then Sudhir. Yeah.
My name is Adnan. I work at the International Growth Center. As a former bureaucrat, I have enough experience of bureaucratic inefficiencies and along the line that metrics were talking about. Also working with Benazir Income Support Program on some of these issues that you mentioned. My question is, like, I want to have your take on the implications of UBI on, say, human agency, individual agency, and human capabilities. And the question is, let me give you the context. When thinking about, say, in-kind versus cash transfers, as economists, we can always reconstruct the budget constraint. If markets are complete, if we have an asset transfer, we could sell the asset and have the same budget constraint, and we have cash, we could use it to buy. And then one thinks of either some market imperfections or inter-household like frictions or bargaining issues or individual behavioral constraints, temptation, you mentioned temptation, self-control. And it's obviously an empirical question. And from one, at least one piece of evidence from joint work with colleagues Oriana and Robin doing a large-scale field experiment in Pakistan on exactly cash versus asset transfers. And so far, the evidence that we're finding is people that who get cash, or at least have the treatment arms are some people get asset and others get a choice between cash and asset transfers, and almost everyone gets cash. And they use the cash to buy the same assets, the same car. And the question is why? Maybe is it a question of agency and capability? Maybe if I choose the cow maybe looks prettier, or I have some way of maybe finding a better cow. But the question is also relevant, even if they have, we're now beginning to see some rents, but even if they have the same effect, the question could be the administrative cost of running a cash transfer are far lower compared to, say, an asset transfer, along with the complementary interventions. So, interested in your take on
that's a great question. Yeah. So I'm happy to take a few.
So we'll take Sunil and Shohini.
Mahesh, I just want to come back to some of your discussions about the principles around this. But perhaps it's useful also to say that the National Rural Employment Guarantee Scheme is one that creates public assets rather than conditional cash transfers, which are by and large private. I think I'm from the Social Policy Department. I work on urban issues, and I have an interest in migration and urban labor markets. And of course, the labor market issue is as big, I think, in developing countries, but from the perspective that it's largely the informal economy. And that brings to mind the notion of risk. When there isn't any kind of unemployment insurance or benefits, people are not risk averse, the poor. They always invest with a view to actually accumulate, but often many times fail to do so. So providing a universal basic income would enable risk taking. So I think that's one aspect of this notion of whether it's linked to labor market questions.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that for my work, I've seen people who sell things on the street, then want to get into a market stall, borrow a lot of money, invest, fail, and therefore are more impoverished than they started. So this question of your instrument versus the objective, sometimes it's not that clear cut, because it's straddling on one hand, labor markets, it's straddling poverty, it's straddling gender inequalities, and so on and so forth. So I just wanted to know
No, these are that's a great point. So maybe
Should we take one more, or do you want to do these three?
Let me take one more, and then I can have my first round of reactions to.
Thanks. I'm Sahi. I'm in international development, but I'm trained as an anthropologist. That's my discipline, where I'm coming from. And I've more recently been doing work on Jannatter, the financial inclusion program in India, and much of it's been brought into programs of cash transfers, essentially. But I guess I have two questions, and they're somewhat related. One is on this shift to cash from in-kind, and we already see this with, say, the cooking gas, the LPG transfers, which the government has already moved from providing direct subsidies to providing cash to subsidize. And whether these shifts to the cash transfer can be problematic in terms of people's access to goods, particularly in times of crisis. So when prices are low or stable, it's easy enough to sort of use cash transfers to pay for goods and then sort of claim the subsidy, but when there's a crisis, then it can, for a household, can suddenly become very difficult to actually buy cooking gas, or if they shift towards food for cash transfers, then again, those become very difficult for households to actually make ends meet. So how do we account for these periods of crisis through cash transfers? And particularly as we see this shift towards basic income over just conditional cash transfers or targeted programs. And a related point in some ways is that often we look at these programs just without the relational context of people on the ground. And so in other places, anthropologists found that, say, when people expect households to get cash, they can also become forms of demand because people know that that person has cash at this time of the month, say. And so moneylenders or other relational demands would come into play at those very moments in which cash comes into the household and everybody knows that there's going to be cash in that household. And so I don't know that there's a real way to fix that, but it does raise a concern about whether in-kind in some ways is, you know, it may be costly overall, but also allows people to keep those goods within their household without the fear that it might be called upon when others know that there's money in the household.
Okay, thank you. So let me, otherwise I'll risk forgetting, so now that I've collected a few questions, but I want others to come back in, and even if they have thoughts on these questions, because I have only started working on it, I certainly will be working on it over the next in the near future. So therefore, I am as interested in learning as to propagating my own views that are evolving on this. So I going back to the first point about the sovereign wealth funds or Alaskan oil fund and so on. Actually, that's a great point, because I think that in a way this is something that Pranab Barthan and I, we were discussing in a recent conference, where we were essentially thinking that a lot of the critique of the UBI comes from that this whole labor market thing, that it's going to destroy people's incentives, it's going to create, you know, there are suitably hysterical titled Wall Street Journal articles saying this is a new form of socialism that will create a completely sort of, you know, the whole world of, you know, passive people who presumably will do drugs and just stay home and play with their computer games, whatever they want to do, and therefore this is such a bad idea, right? And I think part of it, why do I say all of this? Well, I say all of this because it is this whole notion of tying it to labor. Whereas if you feel like, look, if your grandfather left you a piece of land, now we can all have our views on feudalism and inheritance and all of that, but still, that creates a different way of framing the fact that you could have some, you know, fixed income in your portfolio, which somehow you are not having to justify by, you know, working in the labor market, right? So therefore, anything that, you know, for example, think about the tribal displacement problem in India, which is one of the big divisive issues, where in a lot of forestry and natural resource rich areas, the indigenous people are pushed out by, you know, various industrial houses working together with bureaucrats and others who are willing to go along with it. And once again, the moment you create this sense of collective ownership of certain types of natural resources, that justifies paying this out. A, it gives a fiscal opening there, and B, it's framing the problem differently, right? That in some ways, you are getting a share of the collectively owned natural resources in the country. Okay, so this is again, I have learned most of my education here is I think from Pranab Bhaktan, who tells me that this is the call. There's a group of people who call themselves libertarian socialists, and that's apparently that's what they essentially they want to expand this to the whole sort of all natural resources, but their point is that only natural resources and not man-made resources human-made resources that should be collectively owned. That's the bit that didn't work out so well, but natural resources, that's a standard argument.
Mochish, is this a reversal? So there was the tragedy of the commons, so this is a recreation of the comedy of the commons, is it?
This I don't know.
I mean, this is not a debate it's a debate we've had, right? Mm. What collective ownership does to productivity, to sense of dignity, to ownership. What collective ownership does. I mean, Robert Wade is not here, but his book on village politics is brilliant on this, on showing how collective ownership actually transforms. Neighboring villages are completely different. So this is, are these libertarians revisiting the tragedy of the commons debate?
No, as I said, I'm quoting largely out of Pranab's writings so on. But my point is that what they're trying to say is, the best example is the Alaskan Natural, the gas fund, that essentially you say, look, this is owned by the government, and therefore whatever money that is coming out by selling it internationally, suppose Saudi Arabia were to do this, and just to be sort of things, caution to the winds a bit, and essentially all that oil resource then is not owned by a sort of rich group of oligarchs or plutocrats or whoever, it's collectively owned, and then you give it out in the form of some kind of lump sum to the population. That's the
like model. Norway did.
Like Norway,
right?
Exactly right. Norway, yeah. But yeah, relating it to the whole Wade idea, governance of commons, and all of that. That's clearly there are subtleties involved, and I certainly cannot address them off the cuff. But anyway, that's my argument that yes, we should expand the fiscal space, and B, also it's a matter of framing the policy. Going back to Adnan's point. I think that's kind of interesting, and in a way that goes exactly opposite to what you were saying, because his point is, even when cash is being given, they often are getting the same asset, but there's some sense of a welfare gain because you felt you chose it, as opposed to somebody coming and giving you a cow, which I happen to know because I'm also I'm familiar with Robin and Oriana's work on this and stuff that they're doing. So therefore, that I think is a good idea. I'll tell you my, since this is more informal discussion, my personal preference for cash transfers in a limited way comes from a very simple this is more a value-driven argument. I do not like to be at the mercy of bureaucrats myself, and therefore I fully understand that for a lot of welfare recipients, if you look at the recent Guardian piece where Aditya Chakraborty writes about this Finnish case, where he interviewed one of the welfare recipients, and the main argument that chap is making, that look, this money is not enough, I have to do a lot of other things, right, one of the recipients. But the humiliation, the fact that any time I try to do anything, I would have to go to report to some government office and then get that person's approval, that's the bit intuitively to me seems, and that goes back to the empowerment argument, okay? So okay. Now, coming to your points, no, I agree that, look, NREGA creates public assets and cash transfers are just cash transfers. And it goes back to the original argument that you could make the case that is NREGA the best way to create public assets, or should we have a separation where you give cash transfers to solve the problem of poverty or unemployment, whatever it is, and then you provide infrastructure or public assets in the way you would do it? I can't take a sort of, you know, one can't take a priori sort of stance on this because it depends on case to case. But I can say one can equally make the case that you should sort of, you know, let the cache bits do the problems that cache is good at doing, not tying it up with public service creation, public asset creation. You know, it's a bit like you're bundling things in a way that may or may not work out, okay? But I'm just trying to frame it in the sense that there's a trade-off here, clearly. It's not compelling that Nerika creating public assets is therefore sort of, you know, clinches it in favor of Nerika, because on that you could also make the counter-argument that, you know, this is something that critiques of Nerika have made a lot, that there is heterogeneous evidence in terms of where these public assets have been useful, and there is some evidence of that, but there are also plenty of examples where they're basically you just, you know, put in mud and that gets washed out and so on. And again, I'm not, because we are not specifically discussing any piece of evidence here,
My point was of course there are wasteful assets and that's a political intervention as well. Also that people don't work the entire hours they work to get the money. There's lots of things. But the question that we talked about whether this complements or supplements, I think this is where I was trying to make the point, is that some of these edges are so fuzzy that it's neither or not. So on one hand, I mean, Nerika is room. There's no such equivalent on Earth. It doesn't have to be public infrastructure. You could create crèches, for example, and then allow people to go out into the labor market, right? So there are lots of options available there. But while a cash transfer, which is conditional on work but not means tested, might also be alongside the UBI. And I think that's where perhaps the difficulty is, that people are seeing this as, if you provide a universal basic income, then you're going to act on other public services. For example, there was a discussion some time ago, a couple of years ago, about PDS, and to remove PDS and to give cash instead. But that assumes that markets are going to work where you can go and buy your rice and grain.
No, I agree, but just to clarify, food distribution, you're taking a private good and you're finding an alternative to the market mechanism to, you know, distribute it. That's very different from providing sort of streets and infrastructure, irrigation, and so on. I think that in the case of PDS, at least in India, with some exceptions, the general consensus is that it's been an extremely wasteful program. So I don't think that anybody who has done a case study is familiar with the selling off by the, you know, and so on. But once again, I think the general point here is, I'm trying to say is, as much as you should have fish in a coastal area and you should have fish is less available in a non-coastal area, you should switch your diet. I'm saying that policies, we need to take a more flexible approach. That's my point, because otherwise you're tied to this 0-1 position that either I'm going to have to commit myself to cash transfers even when I can clearly see. And I happen to have done a study in Bihar, IGC funded project, where we looked at the bicycle distribution program of the Bihar government, and we actually asked the beneficiaries, would you have preferred cash instead? And then we did some analysis as to who preferred cash as opposed to who said that the bicycle was just fine. And clearly, the more remote the area and the poorer the people, they said the cash is not very useful to us. So in that case, clearly, if markets are not well developed, giving cash is like, to give my, you know, sort of more comical example, imagine Robinson Crusoe, literally, and say, here's some cash. You know, what is he going to do with it? I mean, you know, he's stuck in an island which not much to do. In that case, clearly, markets are not very useful. But by the same logic, you can also see that in urban areas and so on, people would prefer the cash because of the advantage of choice and so on. So I would say that's the way I'm going to think about this problem, as opposed to taking a stance that UBI should be discarded or that we should always go for Nerika-like things. And of course, you can cap benefits. So in other words, to the extent there is a, you know, if there's an issue about somebody who could be qualifying both for UBI and Nerika. So when you say that you can have a menu of options, then clearly there would have to be a way of capping the benefits. But beyond that, at this stage, it's hard to take a stance Because whatever I can say about cash transfers or you can say about more in-kind type of things, we can pick positives and negatives.
So if you're saying it's possible to have a cash transfer and UBI at the same time?
I would say that it's, you clearly, if you think about going back to the illness and treatment argument, clearly I view cash transfers as a nutritional supplement. That would be my analogy. Clearly that doesn't solve typhoid or pneumonia or malaria. So I'm not saying that we should not have credit interventions and so on. So that's my general perspective. We can of course discuss case by case things, but that's my, I don't see a big, you know, a conflict between having general nutritional supplements or some with some more sort of, you know, the fixing, the stunting type problems. The risk point, I actually agree. That's something that will clearly should come up in a discussion. Indeed, some of the case studies do point out that it protects people from some of the risk, and that's a good thing. So I want to quickly comment on your points let others speak. So look, I think some of the discussion, in a way, preempts, I mean, given what we were having. So I think that we really, close friend of mine, Ritika Khera, with whom I agree on 70% of the issues, but on, you know, and she's a big advocate of in-kind transfers. So I once asked her, then why don't you get IIT Delhi, where she's employed, to pay her salary in the form of, you know, giving her the rent, giving her a grocery thing, and so on. And of course, we had a laugh about it. So that's my way of saying that there's a reason why cash exists. There's a reason why we get paid by cash, and we would not prefer a food distribution system where you or I have to go to Tesco to get the bag that has been selected by some dour-looking, bureaucrat for us. This is my way of saying that clearly there are reasons for cash to exist, but by the same token, when I said that in remote rural areas, giving people vouchers or cash is not good enough. Okay? Now, it's easy to say that we should have a mix and we should let people choose, and that's where the devil is in the details as to how you come up with this sort of menu of options, how do you can benefit this. But that would be my way of saying that I'm not ruling out certain types of in-kind transfers. It's just that it should be a more flexible approach, okay? And that's my reaction to LPG and other things. The other thing, again, I know that cash attracts certain types of attention from moneylenders and other things, but that, in a way, is generally true of most interventions, right? If you think about microcredit, people have looked at how it led to domestic disputes and so on, and you have looked at microcredit and so on. So once again, one would have to then compare that whether cash differentially leads to more of these problems, which may well do because it's more liquid and so on.
Yeah, just on this, let's take questions and then I'll come back about how money is kept and stored, whether this Jandhan Yojana's, financial inclusion through banking, whether that makes a difference to how cash is viewed as not cash in the house, but cash in the bank account. But it'd be great to hear that. But Tim?
Tim, as a member of the economics department, I used to think a lot about these issues, but not many. Yes. So I actually want to invite you to think a little bit about this more from, potentially call it, from the donor rather than the beneficiary perspective. So most of the literature I ever contributed to was always thinking what was best for the beneficiaries, and that's a natural thing to think about because it's the beneficiaries we care about. We don't really care about the people who are going to fund us. But I think it's very important not to just think about it from that perspective. So remember Larry Summers had a beautiful one-liner, which was programs for poor people are poor programs. And this is one of the reasons why we should really not embrace targeted programs, because from a political sustainability point of view. So there's always been this argument that universalism is much more politically sustainable. So in the context, in the UK, the example would be child benefit, which is universally. Everyone knows that child benefit goes to loads of households that don't really need the cash, but it's politically sustainable because it's a universal program. And that argument didn't seem to surface at all. But that, where I think in the context of UBI, the sort of rubber hits the road a bit, is sometimes it gets called not UBI, but it gets called citizens' income. I think that's not a trivial distinction, because, and it leads to something I know Tony Atkinson cared a lot about, perhaps not so much in the context of UBI, But if you look back, and this links to the state capacity point, if you look back in the history of building state capacity, one thing that's been really important are programs, having taxes that are passports to accessing public transfer. So Social Security is the classic example. Social Security worked and expanded the tax net widely because people got old age pensions, they got unemployment insurance. They had an incentive to become taxpayers, essentially, because as taxpayers, they were entitled to certain benefits. And I thought one of the central concepts in the citizen's income, I don't know where it figures in the UBI income, was part of becoming a citizen is becoming a taxpayer. Mm. And we're doing it exactly to encourage more people to register to pay taxes. Ultimately, there's income growth over time, and so those guys become net donors rather than net beneficiaries. And so you kind of build state capacity to the idea of building citizens. I think that's kind of an attractive model, and certainly been a lot of the thinking around. So if you look at Britain in the 20th century, rolling out Social Security was hugely important to extending fiscal capacity ultimately, because you've got people that go and harass their employers to become taxpayers, because as taxpayers they need to get all their pensions. So actually, rather than having the state trying to extract tax resources, you actually have people wanting their employers to make them taxpayers. And I think that's very central to this, and didn't really figure it at all. And one other tiny point on this while I'm on it. I think another aspect where beneficiary preferences matter a lot is what governments subsequently do, and I think there's a huge lock-in effect from this when you build social programs, often reflects the incentive. So that are created by the programs you put in place. So in the UK, the example I would give is Gordon Brown in the late 20th century, who was very intent on implementing all manner of programs to increase labour force participation. Because we were locked into a kind of program where that became the right kind of incentive, so encouraging people into work was essentially, now you could take an ideological point of view that he just believed, and his government just believed, that people should work, that it shouldn't be about income, work is something that people should do, there's a kind of moral perspective on work. And so the alternative view is, no, actually look at the system in place. The only way you're going to get the cost of this stuff down, we're getting people into work. I mean, this was an enormously expensive built-in program that was had a lot of people, it was costing a lot of money. He's Chancellor of the Exchequer, he doesn't like spending money, he's balancing the books, so he wants to get people into work. So I think you also need to think about the issue of what incentives you put in place for other kinds of programs once you go down this route. I don't think you can just sort of take one program in isolation and not think of all the incentives you build into the system, because the politicians are actors here too, I guess it's a bigger point. And that's where I think the political sustainability, the political incentives and the political economy are not something you can detach from this whole debate. And I think the reason we're having this debate now is partly because of the political incentives that are driving us towards this debate as much as it is about worrying about beneficiaries.
Could you clarify the last point? I agree with almost everything you said, but this what exactly was the Gordon Brown concern? I just missed this.
Britain had what were deemed to be expensive welfare state, mm-hmm. and how are you going to reduce that? One thing is cut the benefits of people.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But instead, what he did was to introduce welfare to work programs that essentially gave out earnings transfers to people conditional on work. So effectively, the way he cut the cost of the welfare state was by encouraging people to work because the system was effectively subsidising people.
Hmm.
So but that incentive had been built in by a series of whole past decisions
right.
about how the system was structured. You know, if he'd started from the beginning, presumably he would have had the encumbrance of having an existing set of transfer programs, which he was then responding to. And I think a lot of times the reforms happen because of the system that's in place. You can't sort of say, I mean, we could all imagine we wake up tomorrow, rip up every existing program, abolish Enrico, whatever we wanted to do, and start from the beginning. But actually, a lot of times, those transition paths are important. And UBI can be a way out, or it can be a nightmare, depending on where the starting point is, because you're going to set up a bunch of gainers and losers from the starting point. So I don't think the status quo is kind of irrelevant to the kinds of incentives built into the system. So I think that's something that needs to be thought about when we're thinking about how one might move in different systems. So towards the end of the habits.
No, I think that's I mean, and as I said, that, you know, here it was a much more limited scope in terms of really trying to understand where this policy, sort of attraction to this policy is coming from in this developing and developing country context, but even within the more narrow scope as opposed to the broad. I think your point about state capacity being endogenous to some of these policies, that's clearly relevant even within the narrow scope of it. It's not an accident that Britain or US or certainly Scandinavian countries have this big tax base and so on. So I think that's a very good point. And also in terms of building support for certain programs, I think universality. That's the public transportation argument, right? That if you have public transportation that's used by many, that keeps political pressure to sort of do this right, yeah?
Can I just to draw two very general points from what Tim just said, is also, I'm waiting for us to get to the point where we talk about the politics of any policy intervention, right? So when you were saying earlier that if it was your choice or the detractors and so on, the problem with, say, the discussion in India at the moment is precisely the people countering universal basic income are precisely people who are closer to policy making, and, you know, the Sudhir Bhallas of the world, who think that really this, you know, universal basic income is enough, you then can withdraw other welfare measures and so on. You know, these decisions are political decisions, right? And that's why whatever recommendations are made has to account for a much wider set of political decisions, which you touched on, demonetization, we've heard about Jan Dhan. These are all, you know, political exigencies which also, of course, work to electoral cycles. So any kind of recommendation has to take that world of politics. The second point, which, Tim, which you sort of alluded to, and I've thought about this with the welfare to work scheme, is also something that, you know, with anthropologists working with people who actually labor, there is also this issue of dignity, a word that's, I think you've mentioned, Manjush, already, and others have, that the dignity of work and what that does for self-worth and therefore thinking of yourself as a productive individual cannot be measured in financial terms, but does something to the well-being of the population, which presumably you're also, I mean, reduction of poverty is not just about keeping people alive, it's about getting people to function as citizens with all their faculties intact. And that issue of dignity we've found in every single intervention, wherever people have access to work, more than the money, it's the fact that they have access to dignity, that they're earning their income, which is a huge sort of one of those things that you can't quantify, but nearly.
I was going to speak, you can't quantify. I agree 100% with you, but actually it's the one thing that comes out overwhelmingly out of these happiness studies. Controlling
yes.
for income, if you work, you're way happier than people who don't work on the same income.
Right.
You control for every characteristic under the sun. So actually I think it has been quantified very. One of the few things I believe that comes out of happiness.
And it's interesting, isn't it, that happiness was measured soon after in the cabinet after Gordon Brown,
mm-hmm.
right? This was a Cameron idea, wasn't it? To
well, I think
it was in the making before.
The making,
yeah.
But it is. I mean, it's not called dignity there. But, you know, you can show that there's a huge premium on
work,
labor force participation, and happiness.
I suppose looking at Gordon Brown, people won't associate happiness in
there. Sorry, you had a question. You're leaving. I'm sorry.
I'm sorry. I'm
you
got to
go.
Commentary.
Oh, I'm sorry.
I'll speak later on. Sorry.
Thank you.
I
want to raise another issue we haven't discussed so far. So one of the arguments that sometimes people cite in favor of universal basic incomes is very much linked to this idea of scarcity and mental sort of bandwidth, and scarcity that Moola Nathan very much articulates in his book Scarcity and a few papers that I'm sure you're very familiar with. So I think there's sort of a bit of evidence that shows that these effects of, and this is very much obviously linked to the conditionality element of these universal, of alternative programs to universal basic income, the idea that if you have conditions to satisfy, this very much taxes your mental bandwidth and therefore limits your choices or the choices you effectively make. And universal basic income very much addresses this point as well. So have you, what do you think about sort of this take or this perspective in universal basic income?
Sure.
It's the BPL issue as well, isn't it? Are there any other folks? Did you want?
I can answer a question. I'm obviously a fellow in the Department of Anthropology, and I've done research with indigenous communities in Argentina on the border with Bolivia. And I guess why I'm here is that these communities basically depend on conditional cash transfers because it's characterized, the region is characterized by soaring rates of unemployment. But to go back to the question of the citizens' income, I guess I wanted to ask what kinds of, it's a hypothetical question. In a future where let's say universal income has become a widespread policy, what kinds of citizens will benefit more and who won't from these programs? So I guess I'm asking, what kinds of inequalities will this also create in the future? Because I work on a border area, it's a region where there's a huge moral panic about people coming from somewhere else to claim more benefits or and that kind of thing. So if we imagine the scenario where these policies are widespread, what kinds of inequalities would that create? What kinds of political, even at a kind of IR level of analysis, how could different states be using these benefits for their own gain in a way? I guess I'm trying to think about the analyses that you've been discussing, most of them, and most of the stuff that I've read as well, is very state-centric, assuming that populations are stable, that they are in one territory, and that therefore you receive benefits by dint of citizenship. But if we imagine more mobile populations, refugee populations, migrant populations, wealthier populations that can move across the globe, what does that do to our image of a universal income?
Okay, now that's a. So can I just at least in terms of the economists or sort of more policy-oriented discussion, this seems related to the migration issue, that suppose you have a generous universal basic income, then clearly it will also attract, this will in a way accentuate that problem. Is it similar to what you have in mind?
Yeah, I guess so. I mean, it's not a very well formulated yet.
But it's more like different countries having different welfare systems and mobile populations and stuff.
And also, I guess, the differentials within those mobile populations, wealthier or poorer populations that are ones that are moving around.
Okay, so I think, at the risk of provoking Tim into calling me the sort of extreme left-winger that he somehow thinks I am, which is I wish my non-economist friend would believe that. I would say that, look, think about the Panama Papers, think about the world we are living in, Zucman, Piketty, it's the rich who are ripping off the system. It is all the sovereign, all the tax dodging, all the complete way of essentially offshoring the wealth, right? Now, what's happening to the happiness of those guys? Because they are the true parasite class. If you really, that's where I'm playing the role of So my point is, why do we have to, every time we think about universal basic income, why do we have to think about a poor person receiving welfare? And I do agree that, at some level, the point here is to have some sense of agency over your life, some kind of capabilities being expanded. So clearly, I'm not disputing, or I'm taking a very relativist view on that. But we should also think about, broadly speaking, we all derive our incomes from certain assets and our labor power. And I think there's a case to be made that exercising our labor power, being involved in various things, whether that's a good thing because it keeps us engaged, it keeps us feeling good about ourselves, it's connected to others. I agree with all of that. But shouldn't we be having this discussion more broadly as to why do we have this class of oligarchs who are like parasites really, sucking off the money from the rest of the population and, offshoring it and hiding it in all sorts of ways? And then clearly, a lot of these. So is it this more general point that in some ways everybody should be working for a living, everybody should have some productive thing, because that clearly, where I'm going with this, that will clearly go also at the rentier class, right? The entire class of people who are doing that. So that's where I find You know, if that's a more sort of, you know, broad argument, then I'm with you, exactly. But otherwise, I always find there's a little bit of being tough on the poor issue here, that they should be working to deserve any welfare and so on. So I don't know. That thing. Because happiness, I mean, the rich guys, maybe they get depressed. They go to, you know, they go to therapy. They are antidepressants.
Casinos. Gambling. Temptation. No, but Tim, no, seriously, would you disagree with any of this?
Well, sorry. Now I have a price to pay.
I think the issue of the counterfactual is an interesting one. I mean, so you can take an extreme. So you should read Jim Hines's paper on tax havens. His view is tax havens is what keeps over-rapacious governments in order. But actually, there's this very popular view, OECD view, and, you know, Jeremy Corbyn, whoever you want to talk to, even the actually conservatives are just saying the same view. We all hate tax havens. At the end of the day, we do live in threat of the state expropriating people, and tax havens are a method of preventing state expropriation. And I'm not saying I subscribe to that view, but I think it's a very easy view. I just think it's a lazy view to say we think the state is wonderful, we think it maximizes social welfare, and so anything that means the state's power is diminished is terrible. States are not those agents. States are, you know, they do good things and they do bad things, and we need a balance of checks and balances to make sure that the good things the state does. But the other thing I think, I have a side issue with, okay, so suppose we did bring in that tax revenue, you know, that can be spent on a lot of different things. The idea that they're not, you know, that's all going to flow down as transfers to poor people, whatever you think is the priority. I mean, there's a big if. I mean, of course, at the moment, that's what Corbyn tells us he would do if he managed to close all the loops in tax havens.
There's
no reason to think in many other countries the closure of tax havens might be giving more transfers to the buddy of the guy who's the president. So it's not obvious to me that this money is always going to end up where we'd like it to end up, is sitting here and thinking of the plight of the poor.
That's for the politics.
No, I agree, but that's, I didn't say that. My point was more broader point, that even, I think both of your sort of responses are a little off what I said, because clearly the US and the UK is not Saudi Arabia. So if the tax dodges here, you cannot make the Jim Hines argument here, right? That you could, you know, unless...
Jim's paper, because he does make it here, and he makes it for the UK, particularly takes on the US, and he says there are very good reasons why tax havens exist, and they improve tax policy in the US. They don't make it...
Okay, then no, reason, because I think I clearly can
I
see that argument...
That,
yeah,
at least there's a respectable case for the view that tax havens serve a very important purpose for the
accountability
tax policy.
Yeah,
and the other... It's because it's so unpopular to restate that.
Yeah, no, I agree, but on the other hand, I was not at all advocating that any money that's brought out of the offshoring things will be spent on, you know, that I simply said that a rich person who's evading taxes and not working, in what moral plane is he not extracting or being more of a parasite compared to a poor person who's collecting welfare? I think that's the point I'm trying to say, that somebody who's essentially, so it's the happiness point, right? You said people should be working to be happy and so on, and that should apply also to the non-working round-tier classes. That's my point, not that offshore money should be spent only on basic income, or that's a different argument. As to your comment, I think I completely agree. So if you remember the course you took with me, and I... we did discuss this idea that some of the, you know, income transfers can be overcoming essentially just pure income shortages that cause certain, for example, insufficient investment in children and all of that. So therefore, you can certainly extend it a la Mullanathan and Shafir and others to also essentially help them overcome certain cognitive costs of extreme poverty, so therefore that would reinforce the issue. But the flip side of that would, of course, be that it could also create certain income effects that are not desirable. So that's the original discussion we were having about Banerjee and others, you know, the studies that check out what actually goes on. And to be, again, to take a stance on it, I'm not convinced enough that at least in the developed country context, we can dismiss this idea. Because again, I can see for an extremely poor person in a South Asian setting, which I'm familiar with, there I don't really see a danger of people stopping working or spending all the money on what you could say non-merit consumption. But once you have higher levels of income, right, then it's not clear to me. So I would therefore like to see more evidence, and I there may be studies already. Mm-hmm. So I think Abhijit and others, that argument is good, but I think that's largely drawing from developing countries, that the paternalism concern is less of an issue. I'm not so sure. There, I would say I'm more agnostic about some of the critiques of this cash transfers, mm-hmm. that this could lead to some of the labor market effects and so on.
But there are any... Yeah.
Hi, I'm an MSc student in development management, and I was also interested in this because I'm partly Swiss citizen and had to vote on this issue quite recently.
All right, yeah.
And the population voted against, actually. But anyway, I was wondering more in a developing countries context, if you could see this as kind of, or if you could see this initiative as kind of going against the efforts of microcredits and microbanks and microservices in providing, you know, without requiring for any interest, any payments of loans, et cetera, et cetera. Whether it could deter the efforts of empowering the people through credits.
Okay. I'll. So if there are other questions, otherwise I'll...
Yeah, just jumping on this thing about this welfare to work kind of argument. I think last night on, yesterday in Parliament, I think it was a Tory MP was saying that this whole thing about the highest number of people in work at the moment in the UK. And that's a great thing. If you ask anybody who's out of work what they want to work. At the same time, the IFS discussion yesterday and today about wages and how it's going to be 10 years before you get back to 2008 levels. So there's a notion that you can get people into work and therefore you don't have to worry about the notions of the UBI. But also what you were saying about the impact it might have on labour market choices, that people might not go to work and go into drugs. Driverless cars would do the same thing, wouldn't it? But yet when you talk about driverless cars, it's all about creating more leisure time and more time to do other things. But when it comes to UBI, there's a slightly different take on it. And just a thought about how we respond to an economic incentive where there's this redistribution. Whereas you're talking about all the other, the whole ILO's future work agenda is about creating greater amount of leisure.
Let's take, we're going to run out of time.
So Richard Layard is very keen in his happiness work on this idea of the hedonic treadmill.
Yeah.
That basically most of us work when we don't really have to be way above the hours that we're required. But LSE, trying to make LSE faculty work less hard, they don't even do that, but there is an official policy. But we all, when they do these logs of the number of hours, we all work 60, 70 hours a week, and they think that's destroying our work-life balance. So, you know, this idea that, you know, work is good and we should all benchmark ourselves against.
But there's another view, I think,
how many hours we
a comical view also that says that in the future, work will become a hobby. You work only if you want to. You know, it's that kind of notion of where you could take us.
Nilanjan, another question?
Yeah. Perhaps just very briefly, thanks. I'm Nilanjan, I'm at the South Asia Centre. My question is related actually to the taxation question, but also to his question. What do you think is the relationship between the success of the UBI futuristically if the state were to play a stronger role in the control of the price of essential goods?
Sorry?
If the state were to play a role in the control of the prices of essential goods.
I see. Okay, let me respond to a couple of questions. So, look, I think that going back to how Tim formulated it, we really, you know, we can't study this in isolation. So, therefore, some of the how it will interact with other programs that we need to think about. I don't see a problem of, say, people receiving a certain basic cash amount. Suppose you receive a certain amount in your bank every month. With your credit market, labor market, insurance market behavior. I mean, again, there's of course always an amount that will start interfering with it. So I think that therefore at that level, I don't see a tension between them. But on the other hand, going back to the earlier question, if you're flushed with even in a poor area, if people now have this sort of money that's being injected, that will clearly have an impact on the credit market and other things. And these are things that we, you know, it's hard to answer them without thinking through what the interactions would be. So I agree that there will be, you know, even if there were no other programs, just it will have an impact on the, as we are discussing, the labor market, but it surely will have an effect on the credit market. Like Mopalika said, people will have greater demand for bank accounts and so on. And so I think that's a good area to think about, that interactions with different markets. So I can't think, readily think of more concrete things to say other than the fact that the interactions are going to be important to think about the overall effect of such a policy.
Because I guess my point was really thinking in the context of extremely poor areas in which so microcredits and banks go to reach out to the people who would need microloan for extremely basic needs. And so if those extremely basic needs could be met by a universal basic income, then there would be no interest for them to go to those, to get any of those microloans. So I feel like it would work in conflict with this market in those specific areas.
Absolutely, and that in some cases would be a good thing because they'll be out of the, say, clutches of certain money lenders if those needs are taken care of. But again, I think, you know, it's a matter of clearly any reasonable discussion of UBI has to take into account that in a given economy, if every person is receiving a certain cash transfer, you know, and going back to the risk point, in a certain deterministic way, that's going to have impacts, both at the macro level and also at the micro level with different markets. And it's hard to say anything, at least for me, at an abstract level, other than the fact that there will be these interactions. So other than that, I'm just trying to think, okay, Nilanjan's point was, yes, I think that where, and I think this was Tim's broad point, which I did not really engage with because I largely agree with it, that the political economy of it, I mean, you know, policy is endogenous and governments are actors, you know, as the works of political economists have taught us. So therefore, how the whole thing plays out, I just to give you one example of where my thinking here is, I was a much stronger supporter of cash transfers based on this unique identification things, you know, 4 or 5 years ago, and so Jean and Ritika and many others, we have had our conflicts in it. But given the current policy directions in India, I'm much more skeptical now because of concerns of privacy, the concerns of giving the government too much access to information about, you know. So, and yet, there were people who always said that this was the risk, right? Mm-hmm. So going back to your general point, the government has various instruments in their hand. In fact, I think Shalini had asked a good question, which I forgot to respond to. Clearly, price risk is a factor, right? So you can, you know, one downside of these cash transfers is, suppose food is what your main worry is, right? With the cash transfers, unless you have a perfect tracking of prices or perfect inflation adjustment, you're always at the risk of certain market shocks and so on. And so again, I think these are problems to think about. And the government itself controls certain prices, like they control the interest rate, right, through the central bank, and that has macro effects.
Well, they're controlling it already, no? I mean, the GST story that's unrolling in India at the moment, the goods and services tax, and the reclassification of commodities.
Yeah.
So the government is already trying to decide what is a luxury good and what is not, and that itself is very revealing of how this... Had you finished? Because I want to just...
No, look, I think that we in some ways, whether extra time as leisure is a good thing or whether you're... I mean, you know, I spend my formative years right after PhD at University of Chicago Economics Department, where there are a number of very prominent economists who thought there is no unemployment because surely you could be doing some work. So therefore, I'm sorry, I should rephrase it. There's no involuntary unemployment. So all unemployment has to be some form of leisure enjoyment because surely you could be doing something. So I really don't have much to add other than the fact that there is this issue as to what is leisure that is being freed up by technology or income and what is voluntary, what's involuntary. So clearly driverless cars are something that will make the driver a little bit worried because he just lost his job. So that's way, as opposed to universal basic income would say, hey, I have some money, so do I go to the, you know, casino or do I... learn how to pick up some skill. That's a different issue.
I think John Humphreys made a kind of a poke already said, how do you drive a driverless car? Somebody said,
one of my closest friends is a guy called Jerry Cohen, who's a famous Marxist, and was brought up in a Marxist household in Montreal. And he said they used to have meetings, trade union meetings in his house when he was growing up. And he said the biggest debating topic among them was, how are we going to deal with the problem of abundance under communism?
Fantastic. I did wonder whether, as a follow-up, whether we have another session where we talk about concrete cases of how political decisions around policy are actually made, and look at some of the cases, look at Britain systematically, look at, I don't know whether people want to come up with their own work, where we actually look at concrete examples and some, and then look at India or Pakistan, you know, the Benazir income support thing. It'll be great to hear what the three of you have been finding as the next stage of, you know, maybe if we could have a discussion structured around that. Because I think the point that Augustine and Tim were making about citizenship, taxation, welfare, that continuum is, it's the issue of our times in a sense. I mean, you're sitting in the middle of Europe and in the middle of Brexit, which has raised these issues in a way that's made them very obvious and universally a source of anxiety. In a weird way, I had to intervene in this sort of similar debate on the issue of whether non-resident Indians should be allowed to vote, which there's a big move towards this, right? And my point there was, well, should you be allowed to vote if you don't pay tax? You know, and that to me is a fundamental problem. Why should you select a government who you're not paying tax to, or indeed you're not having to live the consequences of their policies? You know, so you live in the welfare state of Britain and choose your government in India. What kind of political choices are you likely to make? So maybe we could sort of have a, you know, in Lent, have another discussion around this, and we'll think about how to curate it. But should we do that? And
or
just
maybe
to continue
a more beverage-focused thing, because that'll be, this is more a motivation thing, but maybe wrap it around.
What should we do?
Yeah. It's just a beverage, I think, because if you go back and read the beverage report, the heart of the beverage report is a link between the notion of citizenship and the rights.
Why don't we drop Tim to lead the discussion?
No, seriously, will you lead will you make 10 minutes of remarks, and then we can take it? Why don't we just circulate the beverage report and read this section?
Yeah.
Yeah, should we do that?
There's a subsequent bit. I can, what's his name? Historian at UCLA who's married to Rousing.
Sigrid Rousing's
her
husband.
Her husband is a historian. He's at UCLA. He's written very interestingly on the history of the link between citizenship and benefits, particularly in the context of beverage. I can't remember his name.
Tim, is it a chapter in the beverage report, a section that we can circulate, or?
There are passages. I don't know that they're joined into a given place, but there's certain passages in beverage where it's very clear that he was dealing with this issue. Of course, it wasn't in the age of Brexit and Brexit, but it was still an issue even then. About this link between the contributory principle and the notion of citizenship.
But I think also, when you're talking about beverage, I think there was an email some time ago about what might be the sixth giant, talking about the five giants of social evil. I think in terms of our discussions, indulgence would be, I think, something to think about. Because it seemed that UBI is an indulgent kind of policy where you're giving money. Indulgence in terms of attitudes as well to commercial citizenship people.
I thought it would come under well-being, no? Which is the fifth one.
Well, I think that is much more about outputs. Here it's about how individuals we act as human beings and what kind of empathy and care and so on and so forth we have. I mean, talking about a policy like this, people have to buy into it. If they don't see the value of this for society as a whole, then it's very indulgent, I think, a very indulgent position that they're taking. It's very selfish, individualistic. I mean, it's a bit like the recent debate about Apple and the tax issue. No, there are they said that it doesn't matter because we're the biggest taxpayer in the world. It's all someone that kind of negated the fact that they were kicked out of Ireland and had to go somewhere else because of the tax issues. So this notion of
They've been reading Jim Haynes.
Yeah, so I think indulgence is, I've been thinking about this a lot, it's quite a powerful way of looking at greed. I mean, Ian Goff's last presentation on his book, Heat, Need, and Greed. He's also talking about this income corridor, where you, there's been some research at Loughborough on what's the minimum you need to live on, and the maximum, something like 150,000 a year you can work with it. So they're talking about this kind of income corridor, which again, you have to buy into that. If not, well, again, that conflicts this notion of needs. You still have this.
There's clearly more to say. Let's, so, Tim, that's the plan then.
Well, yeah, I mean, I have to start on sabbatical next time.
This is the kind of productive activity you do, right? Have fun conversations.
Sorry, can I just ask, was it Peter Baldwin?
Yes, that's the guy. Yeah, he's written a very interesting book,
which is called The Copyright Wars, Three Centuries of Transatlantic Battle.
No,
I don't think that's it. I'll think of that. I can send you a copy of the thing I have in mind. It may just be an article, but I thought it was a book.
But just citizenship and welfare will be great to actually talk about.
We were trying to get into LSE actually as part of the Stonebridge 2.0 program. So one possibility is, I mentioned to Milush today, that we should bring him here.
Yes.
And we get quite good donations from the Ransom Foundation. We've done from all those there. That's the
She's an anthropologist, I know. Yeah. She was a student at UCL.
She's given the substantial sums over the years, and I think they come here regularly. I think they have some money as well.
What do they give money for, Tim?
I don't know. We have to
I'll check, but I think his name is on the LSE Festivals list.
I'd be surprised if we weren't roping him in somewhere.
I'm sure it is.
It's very interesting.
Thank you. Can I just formally thank both of you?
Sure.